Yes. So this last week, I shall be discussing the quantization of gauge theories, which, as you know, gauge theories are the main building block of all modern high energy physics. It's the basic of the universe as we know it. So this would be quantization of. Oops. I'm sorry. Gauge theories. And you already have seen looked at the quantization of the simplest of the gauge theories, which is Maxwell. So Maxwell gauge theory in the CFT1 course. And I remember that the Maxwell theories, in fact, you have only one field, which is the electromagnetic field. And in fact, the Maxwell theory, when it's coupled to so Maxwell plus, for instance, Dirac fermions, which give you quantum electrodynamics, and in fact, describes the interaction of charged particles. You have the fermions, which are charged particles. Okay, so there is a current carried by the particle. This current is, in fact, it's a conserved current, so it's associated to a symmetry, conserved. So it's associated to a symmetry, it's a U1 symmetry, it's a U1 symmetry the electromagnetic charge. And this current is conserved, but you have interaction between this charged particle, and this interaction are mediated by a spin 1 particle, which is obviously, as you know, the photon. So it's very important that the photon as a quantum particle is a spin 1 particle. So it, yes? So this U1 symmetry can be realized as changing the phase of the wave function of the electron. So it's very convenient because for quantum electrodynamics, there is something which is the phase of the wave function, and you have a U1 symmetry which changes the phase. But in fact, I like to view this as just a nice example, because the fact there is a phase in quantum mechanics has nothing to do with the fact that a wave function in any quantum mechanical system, you have a wave function, it has a phase, and the fact that there is a phase has nothing to do with the fact that the particles are charged or not charged. So it turns out that in the simple case of the QED, you can realize the U1 symmetry of the, which is the symmetry of the theory, as just an operation acting on the phase of the wave function. But those are slightly different objects, which you can fuse them in one object in that case, but they are slightly different. They are, in fact, they correspond to two different contexts. I would say the phase of a wave function corresponds to another symmetry, which is the conservation of probability. And it turns out if you have one single kind of particle, and if they are charged, conserving the probability and so forth, the number of particles, if you want, in a non-relativistic framework, is equivalent to conserve the charge. Okay? Yes? Okay, at the moment, there is obviously a global symmetry which is associated. So you know that in Maxwell theory, in order then to add interaction, and to have them mediated by a spin 1 particle. In fact, the trick to realize that is to extend this global symmetry. It's a global symmetry, and it acts on the same component of the field at different points of space in the same way. In fact, the only known way to introduce interaction mediated by a spin 1 particles between matter fields which carry charges is through local gauge interaction. Yes?
U1, does that refer to the fermions or the Maxwell field?
It refers to both. But I will describe that later in the general case. So the important thing is that in order to construct a consistent quantum theory, you need a local gauge symmetry. I never remember if symmetry has 1m or 2m in English. It is a 2m in English. Okay? You need to enlarge this global symmetry into a local symmetry principle, because that's the only way, in fact, to get a consistent quantum theory which satisfies unitarity and Lorentz invariance. Otherwise, as you have probably seen in Kostia Zaremba's lectures, you have problem with the longitudinal modes of the photon. Have you seen that? Yes. And because you have not only the transverse modes, the two polarization modes of the photon, but you have also longitudinal modes, excitation which goes along the direction where the photon moves, and those, if you want to have a theory which is Lorentz invariance, then the norm, the scalar product of such quantum excitation is negative. So you have negative norm state. Therefore, you cannot have both Lorentz invariance and unitarity. You cannot have only positive scalar products. You cannot have probabilities which are always positive. So the only way to do that is to introduce a local gauge symmetry, which, in fact, and thanks to this symmetry, all those unwanted modes decouple of the theory, and you can have them in your calculation, but then you get they do not appear in any physical process. Okay? So the question is, how can we extend this to charges and currents associated to more general and, in fact, non-abelian symmetries? And that's both conceptually very important, and of course it's very important in high-energy physics, because we know from experiments that particles, the quarks and the leptons, carry additional charges, which are not charges of the U1 type, they are just simple charges like that, and they interact between themselves. So we must construct a quantum theory which takes into account those non-abelian symmetry, which takes into account the fact that we have vector particles, so spin 1, or what are called vector particles, and the standard model is built out of some consistent quantum theory we have constructed out of all those ingredients. So we need non-abelian symmetries and currents, and we need vector particles because they are there in our universe. Okay. So the method to do that is to define what are called non-abelian gauge theories. And non-abelian means simply that the gauge group which is associated to the symmetry is non-commutative, because, as you know, most of the interesting groups in physics are not just a group of rotation in one dimension, but are more complicated groups. Okay. So let me give I will mostly discuss here two examples. I will discuss U1 gauge symmetries, and I will discussed the gauge theory associated to the simplest continuous non-abelian group, which is the SU2 group. And then, at some point, I will discuss the general case and what is the general formalism behind general groups. Okay. So, I will consider, in fact, mostly the SU2 group, because that's interesting, but it's not that complicated. So if I consider a series which has an SU2 group, you know, as you know, what is the SU2 group? The SU2 group is just a group of transformation acting on a two-dimensional space, you know, which are it's a group of unitary transformation. Unitary transformation on a two-dimensional complex space with the constraint that so we have a unitary transformation U, which is a two by two matrix. It satisfies U times U dagger equal 1, so it's the analog of a rotation. And in addition, the S means that, in fact, we assume that the determinant of this matrix is 1. Okay? Because this makes the simplest group possible group. Okay? So now think about what does it mean to have a quantum theory which is invariant under the group SU2. So it means that instead, so let us consider a fermion. So we consider that we have fermions, Dirac fermions in the theory, and they carry a charge associated to SU2 group instead of a charge associated to the U1 group. So this means that in fact, instead of having one Dirac field, we have two Dirac fields. We have two Dirac fields. And I will denote the Dirac field, in fact, psi, capital psi. And this big psi is, in fact, it means that it's a vector form of two vectors, psi I and psi 1 and psi 2. Okay? So, in fact, I should be careful here. So, I have two Dirac fields, and they are denoted by an index. So this is by an index I. So I have an index I, and I will explain what those index I refers to in the remaining. Yes? No. You can have, that's because it's the simplest example. But you have a gauge group, in the standard model, they are associated to the U1, SU2, SU3, so simple group. In extended, in grand unified model, for instance, you have O5, you have models. A lot of models have been proposed, but the gauge groups which come out, for instance, of compactification in gauge theories can be some exceptional group, etc. The important thing is that those groups have to be continuous, because they are associated to continuous transformation, so there will be Lie groups. Okay? Or, in supersymmetry, you may have their supersymmetric extension, what are called supergroups of transformation, when you have supersymmetry transformation which mixes fermion and boson, but I won't discuss that. Okay. So, first, I have an index IG, in fact, which refers here to the different component of the matter sector. So the fermions describe the matter. So you have each psi I here, those are Dirac fields, and so I have a big Dirac field made out of two Dirac fields, two independent Dirac fields. Okay. So the I, the 1 and 2 indices are indices related to this group of transformation. Okay. And in fact, for instance, if I'm doing a unitary transformation on these fermionic fields, it means that a global symmetry transformation, will consist in changing this psi field into U psi, or if you prefer, each psi high into UIG, psi G, when I sum over the indices, with U, a matrix belonging to this SU2 subgroup. Okay? And instead of, in fact, So that's a global symmetry transformation, and one may be interested in an infinitesimal transformation. Okay. Where instead of having a big SU2 transformation, I consider a transformation which is very close to zero. And you know that in general, you can write a transformation like that as U can always be written as the exponential of I times some generator that I will write alpha A times a matrix sigma A over 2, where the indices A, B, etc., goes from 1 to 3. So in our case, this indices goes from 1 to 2. This indices goes from 1 to 3. The sigma A's are the Pauli matrices. Sigma A equal 1, 2, 3 are just the standard Pauli matrices. Okay, and therefore, for an infinitesimal transformation, I can write this as 1 plus I alpha A sigma A over 2 plus some other terms if alpha is small. Okay, so the Pauli matrices are 2 by 2 matrices, and you have seen in your lecture in group theory that in fact the 2 by 2 come from the fact that they are generators of the SU2 group. So in fact they form a basis of what is called the Lie algebra of the group SU2. Okay? So you see that in fact, the fact that you have three generators for the group SU2 means that the group is considered as a space, is a three-dimensional space. Its Lie algebra, the algebra of matrices generated by the Pauli matrices, is an algebra which has dimension 3. So these are group indices. Okay, the indices A, B going from 1 to 3 are group indices. And in fact, what you have here is both a definition of the group and in fact a construction of the representation of a group. Because you can obviously represent any element of a SU2 group by a two-dimensional matrix, by a two-by-two matrix, but that's a representation of the group, which is in fact simply called the fundamental representation of the group. So the indices I and G are the indices of this two-by-two matrix. So those indices are indices of the representation indices. Okay. So here I am considering the simplest representation because it's the fundamental representation. And the fundamental representation of SU2 is two-dimensional. Okay. And so you see that you may consider those elements both as the sigma A over 2 are both the sigma A over 2, which I will denote TA, are both form a basis of the Lie algebra of SU2 that I will denote like that, Lie of SU2. So it's a basis of generator of the group. And also they form generators for the and also are generators that I will denote TAR of a representation R, definitely not R, of SU2, which where here R is just the fundamental representation of the group SU2. Okay. So it's a bit of formalism, but it's very useful to understand the following. And of course, the fermion fields are Dirac fields. So in fact, they are they carry indices. They carry Dirac indices. So each psi high has, in fact, carries. And with my notation, this is an. In fact, each psi high has an alpha indices. So the indices alpha beta will be the Dirac indices, and they go from 1 to 4, obviously. Okay. And finally, I will have to deal also with the Lorentz indices. In what? The calculation. So, okay. So for the moment, we have two Dirac fermions, and they are Dirac indices. They are Dirac fields, so they carry a Dirac index. They belong to a representation of the U2 group, which turns out to be, in fact, the fundamental representation. So, in fact, they carry an indices which carries the component of the representation. Okay. And so you have a Dirac field which depends on the position in space, and of course you will have its conjugate field because we are dealing with Dirac fields. So in fact, these are the two components of the Dirac field. Okay. So now we want to gauge this symmetry. So we want to add to this theory. Yes?
You're calling this a symmetry. I don't see why this is a symmetry.
Oh, it's a symmetry. For the moment, it's simply a symmetry because if I consider as an action for this Dirac field something which is just an action. Well, let me write this action here. If I consider an action for this Dirac field, which is the integral d4x, and let me write this in a very standard psi, which means if I take into account all the indices, psi bar I alpha, I gamma mu alpha beta d mu minus m delta alpha beta. And then I had a delta IG psi G beta. Okay? So you see I've taken the action for a Dirac fermions and I simply doubled it for the two components of this larger Dirac fields with the same mass. You see? Then this action is not only invariant under the symmetries of the Dirac Dirac fermion, but it's also invariant under this transformation, because remember that psi bar I alpha is the component of psi bar are the complex conjugate of the component of psi, Therefore, this action is invariant under this SU2 global symmetry group, and that's simply because there is the same mass term for the psi1 component and the psi2 component. So it has a symmetry. And so there is a current associated to this symmetry, and this current, if I am not mistaken, is just something like there is a current G mu, which is a conserved current, but this conserved current now will have some component I and G. There will be a conserved current. In fact, there will be several currents because the symmetry group acts in different directions. So you don't simply have one transformation, but you can make rotation in the three directions, in three different directions, because the group SU2 has dimension 3, and therefore you have three different currents. Okay. So, pardon?
I have a small question.
Yes?
You wrote the symmetry transformation as psi goes to u psi.
Yes.
And then the infinitesimal transformation is psi I.
Oh, then an infinitesimal transformation will be simply that I transform psi into psi plus I alpha A, the polymatrix applied to the psi. To the
so
psi.
Yes. When you wrote psi I goes to uij, psi j,
yes.
You just meant the exact same thing as above.
Yes, yes.
So that's not...
Yeah, it's not simply...
Above is not the general and below...
No, here, I'm just writing in component what is this in terms of... Here there is a vector, and here is a matrix. And here it's a component of the vector, and here it's a component of the matrix element. Yes?
Sorry, the way you've written the current, should that be an A in the index A, or do you mean antisymmetric IJ, or...?
Yes. In fact, it should be an AB, but there should be, yeah, I'm sorry. There should be, but I will come to that later. There should be three conserved currents, because they are through three generators, so they will be labeled by the indices of the group. Okay. Okay, so, but let us... Yes?
So you see the SU2 is two-dimensional.
Yes.
But it's not. There's three Pauli matrices. You need all three to
I am wrong. No, I'm sorry. Yes, the group is three-dimensional, considered as a real D group. Okay, because those alpha are real, and it can be realized as represented as a group of transformation in a two-dimensional complex space. But as a Lie group, the group SU2 is three-dimensional. You are right. Sorry. Yes. Okay, so now we want to introduce a gauge field and a gauge invariance principle to introduce interactions between those fermions and between those currents. Okay, so in order to do that, in fact, the gauge field, so we have to introduce a gauge field which will be, as usual, a field which is called A mu. It will be like the vector potential in electromagnetism. But the gauge transformation that I will write a bit later should correspond to gauge transformation associated to this kind of gauge transformation when now the gauge transformation is made local in space and time. And therefore, what we have to do is, this gauge field has to belong to the Lie algebra of SU2. So in fact, there should be, three components. So, in fact, we need to introduce three components of A mu. So we have here three gauge potentials. Okay? So instead of having one gauge potential as in SU in the Maxwell free. We have here three gauge potentials, okay, and which will transform according to the law of the group. So in fact, we can recast them in a big gauge potential, which is in fact the sum over each. So this is a number. It's a gauge potential will depend on the position of space. It's very important. Okay. Okay. So in fact, these are numbers, and I can make a linear combination of those fields multiplied by the generator of the Lie algebra. So in fact, it's a gauge. This is a gauge potential which lives in the Lie algebra of SU2. Okay, so it is in fact what is called a connection on the gauge group. Okay. Okay. And you may like, in fact, since the SU2 group is a group of transformation, you may represent this gauge field as element of the in the space of polymatrices generated by polymatrices. So you may like to represent mu in the what is called the adjoint representation of SU2. Simply, it means that I will represent the generator of TA as 2x2 matrices. And in that case, you see that those A mu can be if I represent the TA by saying that the TA has 1 over A sigma A, the polymatrices. Yes?
The adjoint representation.
Yes.
We think of the dimension of the representation matrix, the dimension of the matrices.
Yes.
Of that representation being the same as the dimension of the group, which in this case would be 3x3.
Yes. So yes.
But that's not what you mean here, right?
Ah, yes. No. I was simply. So here you see this gauge field has three components, okay. But if you think of representing the TAs as 2x2 matrix, but that's often done in the calculation, so that's what I wanted to do, which are the polymatrices, okay. I can think about this gauge potential as being represented as antisymmetric, traceless, 2x2 complex matrices. Okay? But that's in fact, perhaps it's a bit confusing. So let us keep this like that. Okay? And now, what I want to do is that I want to gauge the transformation. So instead of considering, in order to introduce interaction, instead of considering global gauge transformation, I want to be able to be infinitesimal local infinitesimal gauge transformation. So I want to make transformation of symmetries both on my Dirac field and on my gauge field which correspond to a transformation of the form one plus I alpha A of X TA, where the TA are the generator of the group. So this is a local information gauge transformation. I take a matrix U, which is of this form. It's the identity plus some small transformation where alpha, but now this depends on X. And I want to see what it is. Okay? So I know what it is when it acts on the gauge on the fermion field. What I need to do is that I need to do how making a local infinitesimal gauge transformation acts on the gauge field. And here I will give the recipe. The recipe is that when I am doing such a gauge transformation, the gauge field A mu, which is a function of x, will be transformed as mu of x. And you know that in gauge theory, in the U1 Maxwell theory, a gauge transformation corresponds to changing by the derivative with respect to the direction mu of the gauge parameter. Okay? And that's exactly the same here in gauge theory, except that the derivative is here d mu has to be defined in a slightly more general way. And here the derivative d mu has to be is equal to what is called the covariant derivative. And we shall see why we have to do that. Okay? So what is the covariant derivative of alpha, d mu of alpha? So remember, in fact, alpha that I wrote here, so I am writing alpha will be simply alpha the x between will be simply this sum over alpha a the x t a the x. So it's a function, it's a function on the Lie algebra of the group. Okay? So this gauge parameter, this infinitesimal gauge parameter, is a function from x onto the space generated by all the three generators of the Lie algebra of SU2. So it's a function on the Lie algebra. Okay, and of course I have to define what is d mu of alpha of x. And d mu of alpha of x will be simply be taken as being the ordinary derivative, d mu of alpha of x. So this is the ordinary derivative in space-time. But then I had a term which is simply and if you think in terms of Pauli matrices, this will be simply the commutator of A mu and alpha. So this will be, in general, what is called the Lie bracket. Or the usual commutator. When you realize the TA as Pauli matrices. Okay? And what is the. Because remember, alpha is an element of the Lie algebra. So it's element of the. Belongs to the Lie algebra, Lie of SU2. And each component A mu belongs also to the Lie algebra. So each A mu belongs to the Lie algebra of SU2. And in a Lie algebra, you have the generalization of a commutator, which is called the Lie bracket. And for SU2, this Lie bracket is very simple. In general, oh, that's something very important. For a group, you have the Lie bracket of TA and TB. It's an antisymmetric form, so it's minus T by TA. It has to satisfy what I call the Jacobi identity. We have seen in gauge theory, in group theory, and in fact, for SU2, and in fact, what is important is that the commutator of TA and TB defines, in fact, can be expressed into the generator of the algebra, and therefore there is a matrix FABC with when I am summing over C, where these are called the structure constants of the group. And for SU2, the structure constant of the group are simply, so let me write this here. For SU2, the structure constant of the group are simply FABC equal the epsilon symbol ABC. Remember, A, B, and C goes from 1 to 3. And this is simply epsilon ABC is 0 if some elements are the same. It's 1, so we have epsilon 1, 2, 3 equal 1. And otherwise, it's a signature of the epsilon ABC is in fact simply the signature of the permutation, which sends you 1, 2, 3 onto A, B, and C. Okay. These are this correspond here when I represent the generator of the SU2 algebra as Pauli matrices normalized by the factor 1/2. This corresponds simply to the commutation relation, the famous commutation relation of the Pauli matrices, which tells us that sigma x, sigma y equal 2 highs sigma z, for instance. This corresponds simply to this famous commutation relation for the Pauli matrices. Okay? And therefore, you see that this is a very compact way to write what is the covariant derivative of a function on the Lie algebra in terms of the ordinary derivative and the Lie bracket of the gauge field. So of course, this depends, I should be very careful, this depends on x. Alpha depends on x. So it's a combination of function of x, alpha of x, and the gauge field A mu of x, but it doesn't depend on the derivative. And if I write this in terms of components, you see easily that this corresponds to write, so think about it in terms of component. This will correspond to write that the covariant derivative of the component alpha A of X, remember, one of the component of the gauge group, has to be equal to the ordinary derivative of alpha A of X. And then there is a minus, and so there will be a plus, a new term, which will be there will be an A mu A of X, an alpha B of X, and a coefficient F A B C times FABC.
Sorry, your
embed
structure, the first should be C,
right? I'm sorry. Yes, here there is an A, so it's in fact, I could write it like, well, with the anti-symmetry, I think it's something like that. Because I'm looking at the component which is here, the component C, so I should write this as, if I'm right, B, C, A. Okay, but, well, in the case of the group SU2, since the F A B C is epsilon ABC, I can reshuffle the things and everything works fine. So you see, so the covariant derivative of the gauge gauge generator alpha A is the ordinary derivative plus a combination of alpha times the gauge potential. Okay? So once I have been doing that, now here comes, and I will use that because it's important. For the moment, I've just been doing mathematics. Yes? Because here I don't pay attention whether it's up or down, because that's the same thing. So, but I should have put this high. Oh no, here it's up, so it should be DCA, and which is the opposite of that, but it's not important for SU2, otherwise you have to be a little bit more careful. Okay, so first I have defined here what is gauge transformation on the gauge field. Okay? I know what is the gauge transformation acting on the matter field. It's just multiplying by this phase. Okay? And now here comes the so let us write it once again. In the same global way than we have this definition, which is global, for the what is the covariant derivative and what is the action of the gauge transformation on the vector field. Let us rewrite what we've wrote here just in terms of polymatrices for the action on the matter field or the fermions on the fermion, on the matter, if you want. This is the matter content of a theory. When I am doing a gauge transformation, I am changing the field psi of x into psi of x plus I alpha A times the generator A here, the generator A in the representation R of the matter field psi. So remember, psi is a 2x2, it's a Dirac field which has two components, so it's a 2x2 vector. To each generator of the group SU2 is associated its representation in this representation in the 2x2, in the two-dimensional representation of the group SU2, which turns out to be the fundamental representation of SU2. But here, each polymatrices are considered as some representation of the generator in the fundamental representation of SU2. So this is a 2x2. This is a two-component vector. This is a 2x2 matrix. And I multiply this vector by this 2x2 matrix, and I get a two-dimensional vector, which is here psi of x. Okay? And now, since I am doing with studying a gauge transformation, both psi depend on x and alpha A depends on x. Okay? And you could do the same thing. So in fact, this formula is not very important whether the field is a fermion or if it's a boson, because in any case, in fact, you could each matter field lives in some representation of SU2. So this is a characteristic of the representation R of the group G here is SU2. in which the matter field lives. Okay. So now here comes the important thing about quantum, about gauge field, which is, can we generalize what is the electromagnetic tensor or the field strength tensor to non-abelian for non-abelian gauge field? Pardon? I will do that, of course. But before doing that, I will proceed by steps as was done for the Maxwell field. Now, first, we have just have an electromagnetic potential, the non-abelian analog of an electromagnetic potential. You see? Okay. Now I want to define something which is invariant, which is the electromagnetic tensor, which contains the electric field and the magnetic field, and which is supposed to be gauge invariant. Yes?
Can you repeat why we are considering two fermion fields?
I'm considering two fermion fields because I want to have an SU2 non-abelian gauge symmetry acting on this fermion field. So if I had only one Fermi field, I could only change its phase. So I could only have an...
What do we have, like three or five?
I could have three or five, but if you had three, then you could realize the symmetry of the group SU3. You see? Or you can consider, for instance, a three-dimensional, three fermion field are belonging to some higher dimensional representation of the group SU2. Okay? So I'm considering two Dirac fields simply because it's the simplest case where I can deal with a non-abelian symmetry. I need at least two Dirac fields to consider a group of symmetry which is SU2, okay? And I need two if I am considering the fundamental representation of SU2. If I were considering a higher dimensional representation of the group SU2, then I would need more than two Dirac fields. I could have three dimensions, three Dirac fields, four Dirac fields, etc., etc. But that's more, it can be done. Simply, the generator of the group in this representation will not be the polymatrices, but there will be more complicated tensor product of polymatrices. But this can be done. Okay. Okay, so now let us come back. What is the field strength? So what is the analog of the electromagnetic tensor? Electromagnetic tensor for non-abelian gauge fields. Okay? So, is there some F mu nu of X which has nice transformation properties? In fact, there is one, and it is defined simply as, and if I am right, there is an I factor here, so if you consider the covariant derivative, you see, defined in this way, so acting on the Lie algebra of the field, you may consider the commutator of two covariant derivatives, okay? And if I consider the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on something, I will obviously have something which will, I will have a d mu d nu minus d nu d mu, which gives zero because of partial derivative commutes. And then I will have some complicated object coming from the fact that something more complicated coming from this usual Lie bracket of commutator, something non-trivial, but not depending on the derivative, coming from this, you see? And if you compute this object, in fact, is just an element of the algebra, exactly like here. So, if you make the calculation of this non-trivial object, you found that this is its component, f mu nu of x is just, so it can be represented in a basis of the Lie algebra, so it's something like that, TA, because it belongs to Lie algebra of SU2. Okay, so it's a tensor with Lorentz indices. It's an antisymmetric tensor here, but it's a vector in the space of it lives in the same space as the gauge field in terms of its components. So it has three gauge components. So it has three gauge components. A equals 1, 2, 3. And if you compute this object, f mu nu A of x, you find that this is equal to d mu, the partial derivative, times A nu A of x, minus d nu A mu A of x. So this is the term we are used to in the definition of what is the electromagnetic tensor in quantum in the Maxwell theory. But then, of course, you have an additional term which comes from the fact that you have non-trivial commutator here. And if you do that, you discover that there is a term which is, of course, proportional to the commutator. So there will be an FABC, a term proportional to the structure constant of the group, a term which vanishes for the U1 theory. And then you have a product of the gauge potential with the component ABC. You see? So this is a formal definition of what should be the electromagnetic tensor. Okay? And when you do the calculation, you found that it's in fact it has three components, and each of its components is given by this formula. You see? And you see that this is the usual term which comes from the Maxwell theory. Okay, and this is a new term which comes from the fact that the SU2 is non-abelian. So it has a non-trivial commutation rule. Okay? And remember that, for instance, you know that the structural constant here is a completely antisymmetric tensor. Therefore, this is antisymmetric in BC. So if you interchange mu and nu, you can interchange both B and C, and you check that this is consistent with the fact that it has three gauge components, and it's an antisymmetric tensor in the Lorentz indices. Okay? Okay. Okay. So this is really the analog in a non-abelian a theory with a non-abelian gauge potential of what is the Maxwell electromagnetic tensor in the abelian Maxwell gauge theory. It's the same. Simply, you have to take into account by this term, which is non-linear in the gauge potential, the non-trivial commutation relation of the group. You see? But why is this field strength tensor interesting? It is because, so I think I will erase that, just keeping in mind these rules about the indices. And the fact that for SU2, Remember, for SU2, we have that SU2 FABC equal epsilon ABC. Okay. The advantage of everything here is that everything is covariant. So in particular, this field strength transforms under a gauge transformation in a nice way. You know that in Maxwell's theory, the field strength is a gauge invariant. If you make a gauge transformation like that, you change the gauge potential, but you don't change the field strength. So you do not change the electromagnetic, the electric field, and you do not change the magnetic field. Okay. In a non-abelian gauge theory, it's a bit more complicated because if you want to compute how, when I make a gauge transformation like that, you see, how does f mu nu of x changes? It turns out that f mu nu of x changes, but it changes in a way which is simple because it's simply the Lie bracket of the gauge transformation with the gauge field, the field strength tensor itself. So, and here you see that you have the commutator of those two objects or the Lie bracket which comes into account. So here you have a new term which is present because the symmetry is non-abelian. Yes?
And you have covariant groups that are designed to transform covariantly.
Yes.
So you can see for a finite transformation, it's quite easy to see how it transforms.
Ah, yes. So it means that, in fact, if I am doing a finite transformation, well, let us first give me the expression in terms of component. Remember? F mu nu, in fact, is a compact way to write the three components of the field strength tensor. So in terms of the field, the component A of the field strength, it behaves like F mu nu A of x times, and this commutator means that I have here a, I don't remember if I have an I or no I. It's F A B C, alpha B of x, F mu nu C of x. Okay, so this is written in a compact way, and this is written in terms of the component of, so the component of the field strength tensor, and the component of the infinitesimal gauge field transformation. Pardon? There is.
Which you write as IFABC.
Yes.
You have a nice word which gives you a minus sign.
Yes, there's probably an I. So I can to check with what I. Yeah, you are right. There is an I. Yes.
In this kind of method, could you write out the covariant derivative, like the gauge term and the covariant derivative for an abelian gauge theory? Like I'm just trying to see where the commutator comes in there. Is that the definition, or so? Like, if you had an abelian gauge theory, what extra time would you get in the covariant derivative there?
Well, take this as a definition, because in fact everything here takes this as a definition, and from this definition, and this definition for the matter field, you can derive everything. You define f mu nu as this, and using this and applying it twice, because this is an element of the Lie algebra. So this is a definition of the covariant derivative acting on anything living inside the Lie algebra.
So this is just the terms we need to make this gauge.
Yes. Once you have this definition, you apply it. You do the simplest calculation and compute the commutator, and you end up with this definition just by computing.
So like in abelian gauge theory, you still have another term then, right?
In abelian gauge theory, you have these terms, you have this commutator, but in an abelian gauge theory, so for you, the U1,
So it goes to zero. But do you have an
for U1? In fact, for U1, you have just A equal 1. You see? So you have no. And you have that F. You could only have F1, 1, 1. And it has to be an antisymmetric tensor with just one component. So this is obviously 0. So therefore, for an abelian gauge theory, this term disappears, and the covariant derivative is just the ordinary derivative. See? And so when I compute again, you get just that the electromagnetic tensor is just this standard combination of antisymmetric combination of derivative of the gauge potential, and you don't have this term.
So that's like a variant derivative in the adjoint representation. That's why it's confusing.
Yes, so this is the definition of this is the definition of the covariant derivative. So this is the covariant derivative. Yes, that's what I wrote here. This is the covariant derivative acting on anything which I call alpha of it living in either the Lie algebra of SU2 or that's equivalent to adjoint representation of SU2. Okay? If I consider that they live in the Lie algebra, this is just the Lie bracket, which is defined by the FU, the constant. If I think, oh, but I am living in the adjoint representation of SU2, then take this simply as the commutator of matrices. But you will get the same result at the end. Just two different ways to compute. Okay? Okay, so now you ask the question of that's for an infinitesimal representation. Infinitesimal representation. Now, if you want to think of this group representation in terms, pardon, infinitesimal, I'm sorry, infinitesimal transformation. Okay. Now, if you want to term of non-infinitesimal. Representation, namely transformation U of X belonging to SU2. So to each point of space-time, I associate an SU2 transformation. Then, in fact, F mu nu of X considered since I am in the fundamental, so I may consider that F mu, the F mu nu, so I may consider that F mu nu of X is F mu nu A of X times TA, the generator, and I can, if I choose as the TA, the polymatrices, so if I go to F mu nu A of X sigma A divided by 1/2, well, these are the polymatrices. Polymatrices. Okay. This will be each element F mu nu will be a 2 by 2 anti-symmetric traceless complex matrix. F mu nu. And then, in fact, if I am doing a non-infinitesimal transformation, so I applying a gauge transformation U of X, F mu nu of X, which is now a two-dimensional matrix, is transformed into, and then I don't remember exactly if it's one of the opposite, but I think it's simply something like U dagger of X times F mu nu of X times, oh no. There is a d mu, so it's Oh no, no, that's it is just this. So. Pardon?
The first one should be U, the second one be W.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you see that making a gauge transformation in a on the vector field on the electromagnetic tensor in a non-abelian gauge theory means I make a gauge transformation on the so I make a symmetry dependent on the space-time on the right and I make the opposite on the left. You see, so here I am doing a symmetry transformation depending on space-time. Here I am doing the opposite transformation. Remember that U is an element of U of X belongs to SU2. Okay, so U times U dagger is equal to zero. And so you see that's for SU2, and you see that, for instance, if you are considering the same thing for the group U1, you know that if I'm applying this for the same group for the electromagnetic tensor and not the SU2 field strength, I would have exactly the same results. I would have that F mu nu electromagnetic of X is changed where I multiply by a phase depending on X, and here I multiply by the opposite phase. But here, this is a pure phase. This is a number for which mu nu is a pure number, so this is, of course, equal to F mu nu electromagnetic of X. So you see that in electromagnetism, the field, the electromagnetic tensor is gauge invariant. While for a non-abelian gauge theory, the analog of the electromagnetic tensor, which is a field strength tensor, is covariant under gauge transformation because you make a transformation on the right and the opposite transformation on the left. But this is a matrix, this is a matrix, this is a matrix, so those objects do not commute. You see? But now with those two, I have everything that I need to build an action for the gauge field and an action for matter, which is gauge invariant, and I will end up there. I will just write the action, and we will discuss it tomorrow. I will take the generalization of the action. So let us first take. I will take as an action for the gauge field. Then I can take something which is very similar to what was done for electromagnetism. I can take as an action for the gauge field, mu, simply the integral over four-dimensional space-time of, and with normalization, I will take, there will be a trace. I will take the trace, I will introduce a normalization factor which is 4 for convenience. I will introduce a coupling constant here, and I will take F nu nu, F nu nu. And you see that if I am doing that, so remember, F mu nu now in this representation of SU2 is a 2 by 2, so each F mu nu. Each component F mu nu is a two by two component matrix. You see, so I can take the products of those two matrices. Remember, F mu nu here in my representation, F mu nu is a 2 by 2 anti-symmetric traceless matrix. Pardon?
The F mu nu, they're both all downstairs.
I can write this in a covariant way. It's not important for, but you're right. No, you are right. I am using my matrix. Remember that I am always using now my matrix, which is that H mu nu is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So it's different from what is used in Peskin books, but it, here it's not important because you have always two indices to raise and two lower, so you have always two products of these indices, so it make no difference with the notation of Peskin. Pardon?
When you take the trace, you get a 4. Because of the normalization of the...
So you would prefer the normalization 2?
Well, that's the one that Peskin uses.
Okay, so I... Ah, okay, so I have one difference. I don't know, in my notes I have a 4, and I kept with a 4, so I think for my consistency... Let us keep the 4. Anyway, it will be in the definition of this G, which is a Kubelik constant.
No, it's the definition of the... taking the trace of the...
Oh, it depends on how you define the trace of the... Okay, yes, all right. Okay, so, well, at the moment, let me keep that. That's not very important. So here you have a coupling constant, a term, a coupling constant, which will play a very important role in the rest. And now I have an action. What is the action for the fermions? So I have an action for the fermions, psi and psi bar, remember? And remember what at the beginning of this lecture I just said, okay, let us take the usual psi bar of x, I d slash minus m psi of x. Remember now that f psi of x is a two-component vector because it has two components, psi I equal 1 to 2. So this is, in fact, I have a two-component vector. And we have seen that if we don't introduce so this was for free fermions, and what we simply have to do is to replace the ordinary derivative by the covariant derivative here. So the covariant derivative acting on fermions. Remember that the covariant derivative is d slash, this is of course gamma mu d mu, where d mu is a covariant derivative, and remember that d mu is, with my notation, the ordinary derivative and where is it written here, and we will have minus I a mu a times the generator in the representation of my vector field of the TA. So this depends on X acting on A. And remember that for, in my case, since the psi are also a two-component vector, so psi is psi I equal 1 to 2, and therefore the T A R are just also the polymatrices which are 2 by 2 matrices. So if I want to think about what does these terms means in terms of component of all the fields, and if I want to write everything carefully, this will be, to be careful, this will be integral over d4x. So I will have psi bar a alpha, there is a Dirac index and an I index representing. Here I will have an I gamma mu alpha beta. Then I will have delta IG d mu minus I A mu A of X, my generator, which is one half here of sigma A IG. So these are the 2x2 components of the polymatrix. Minus, so this is for M, and then there is a minus, and then I will have a delta alpha beta, delta IG M, and then I have a psi beta G. So this is, yes?
Sorry to stop you. I'm just confused again about the action of the gauge field. Is that a kinetic term with a coupling at the front?
This one?
Yeah, it looks like a kinetic term that's coupling at the front.
We shall discuss the form of this important term, which is very important later. But you see that F mu nu contains both a term involving derivatives and a term involving the products of two gauge fields. So when you take F mu nu times F mu nu, and if you take into account all the indices, you will see at the end that there will be an ordinary Maxwell term, which will be involving only derivative. There will be a product of this Maxwell term with this, so we will have a term involving three gauge fields with some derivative, so it will be some interaction terms. And there will be a product of this with this, so we'll have a product involving four gauge fields. So in some sense, these terms will contain, and we shall discuss that tomorrow, it contains both a term which is linear, which is quadratic in the A's, which represent the propagation. There will be a term like that, which will represent, so this represents the term of AAA. This represents an AAA, and there will be a term like that, AAA, which represents the term. So this term contains both propagation and interaction of the gauge degrees of freedom. But they are contained in this very compact form because it is the only form which is covariant, because you can check that it's only the term which is covariant, which is invariant under gauge transformations. Because you can check that because of this transformation law for the stress energy tensor or this global transformation law, here there is a U and here there is a U dagger. So if you make the multiplication twice and you make the trace, the U and the U daggers go to 1. So the gauge field is coupled to itself because F mu nu contains nonlinear terms to A mu. So imposing gauge invariance and the gauge field implies that there will be interaction between the gauge field and itself, which is a novelty compared to electromagnetism, where the photons can only interact through the interaction with the matter, with the electron and positron field. Yes?
The trace, the big time, it could still be gauge invariant.
Yes, but this term, you may have the determinant, except that you have to make it also Lorentz invariant. But you may have trace of 4, 3, 4, 5 terms, etc. This term is required when we shall discuss the renormalization of this theory. these terms. First, it's the simplest one. But second, if you, it's the only one which is allowed if you want to have a theory which is renormalizable in four dimensions, therefore consistent. Higher order terms will appear, may appear in some higher dimensional theory or in effective field theory, but because of gauge invariant, because of renormalization, it's the only term which is allowed. Yes?
Because we want the action to be a bilinear form in the field meeting.
No, in fact, there is no reason for an action to be only bilinear in this. But it turns out that it's the first non-trivial term we can construct. And second, it's the only term which is consistent with the quantum theory in four dimensions. So it's the right one. I will explain perhaps that a bit when I shall discuss the renormalization of quantum theory. For the moment, it's just the simplest one, and in also, of course, it's the simple generalization of the Maxwell field, the term form for the U1 theory. Yes?
Why do they need to be three gauge fields?
Why?
Why are they three separate gauge fields?
You mean the three indices here?
That
one comes from the fact that when I take, well, I prefer to discuss that tomorrow in detail, but simply, when you take the product of F with itself, you obviously have, since you have a term which is linear in A and a term which is bilinear in A, and you take the product, you will have three, a term which will be in both three.
No, I mean, why does A have three gauge indices?
Or why the A's are three indices? It's simply because the SU2 group has three generators. You see?
Is that somehow mathematically required that you must have three?
It's the definition of the SU2 group. You know, the SU2 group is the analog. It's an analog of rotation in complex space. And in a complex space, in fact, you can turn things in three directions. It's like if you take the SO3 group, and you know that, in fact, the SO3 group is deeply related to the SU2 group. Because, in fact, they share half of the same representation. If you look for the simplest non-trivial group of transformation, which is non-abelian in real space, in two dimensions, rotation are trivial because it's just rotation, so it's an abelian group. In three dimensions, it starts to be non-trivial because if I have something like that, I can rotate it in a non-trivial way, but then I can rotate it in this direction. I can rotate it in this direction, and I can rotate it in this direction. So there are three ways. So there are three generators to the group of rotation in three-dimensional space.
Okay,
and that's the same here. Simply, in two-dimensional complex space, you discover that there are also three different ways to rotate things. So there are three generators.
Okay. Why do you need a gauge field for every generator?
Because simply, that's what I. Oh, I have erased that. That's simply because if you can state it, for instance, you can view it, for instance, if you want to define the coupling of a gauge of a vector field to a matter, you need to add a gauge field here to the covariant derivative, and the gauge field is coupled to the generator of the symmetry group. You see, when you are doing you make a symmetry transformation on your matter fields, a symmetry transformation of the matter field is some linear transformation in the space of fields, of matter fields, which is correspond to some matrix. It's a linear transformation, so it's given by a matrix. And there must be one matrix for each different independent transformation associated to the symmetric group. So for instance, here there must be one matrix for our Dirac field to be a polymatrix. A polymatrix associated to each kind of transformation. So you need here three, you have three transformations possible, so you have three generators, and to each generator must be coupled one of the field of the theory, one of the gauge field. So you need three gauge fields.
Okay. So is it more like instead of in electromagnetism, we usually start with the gauge field, here we start with the transformations, and it requires that there must be three gauge fields.
Sorry, I missed the beginning of your lecture.
In electromagnetism, you usually start with the gauge field.
Yes.
And from that, you see what the gauge transformation must be.
Yes.
But in this case, we're starting with the transformation and seeing that it requires three gauge fields.
Yeah, but that's two ways to see the same thing. You know? Gauge theory is simply some well-defined consistent object, and you can view it either as imposing the transformation on the matter field and then gauging them, or taking the gauge field, introducing the gauge symmetry, introducing the gauge field, and then coupling it to the matter. That's two different ways to construct the same object. But anyway, you need one gauge field per different kind of transformation which generates your group of transformation. So for electromagnetism, it's U1, so we have only one gauge field. It's standard gauge field. Here we have three kinds of transformations, so we need three gauge fields in order to treat this symmetry in a consistent way in the quantum theory. And if we had the group of SU3, for instance, I think SU3 instead of SU2, the group of transformation in three-dimensional complex plane, I think it has eight generators, am I right? Yes. So you need, in fact, eight gauge fields for SU3, etc. Yes? You ask whether it's possible in experiments to see whether there's a number of. I don't know very well the history of how everything was discovered.
Quite the standard model, of course.
Yeah, in the standard model, I think people slowly realized in experiment on the weak energy interaction that they had current interactions, interaction between currents, which were carrying more structure than just the electromagnetism. So they at some point they had to realize that they needed a current associated to an SU2 group. So in the standard model, you have the standard U1 group of electromagnetism and the SU and some other currents which are called the weak currents, which are associated to an SU2 group. So it was somehow an experimental indication. But the situation is much more complicated in the electro-weak model because, in fact, the way the symmetry is realized is not realized in a simple way that I have described here because of what is called the X model. So it's
they find
yeah, I think so. But I'm not. Ask Michael Peskin in a few weeks or a few months, because he's an expert in the history of high energy physics, and I'm not. Or look at his books where he describes, or in some other books. In fact, as usual with physics, in fact, you often discover a simple structure by very tricky way. It's usually not you don't just discover something from scratch. And that's the case in high energy physics too. Yes?
The gauge interactions between the fields, the reason that the weak forces confine to atoms. Like, for example, in electromagnetism, you don't have interaction between the gauge fields, and so you see propagation.
Yes.
So is that the reason?
Here it's not the case, because the gauge fields are interacting. And in fact, they are interacting quite strongly.
So is that why it's confined, like the weak force to inside the atoms?
Is it the way the weak force is confined?
So you don't see the equivalent of light coming into your eyes from these photons, for example? So it's an internal...
Somehow. But the real mechanism was why the interaction mediated by vector bosons in the real world are screened but for the electromagnetic forces is quite subtle, and it's more complicated than just saying that they are coupled. They have to be coupled in some way. And the way, for instance, the electroweak forces, the force associated with this SU2 cross U1 group, which in fact mediate the weak interaction forces, they are screened in a way which is called the X mechanism, which is different from the way the SU3 interaction associated to strong interactions. So this is the electroweak interaction. There is a group associated to the electroweak interaction. These are confined. In fact, they are screened by a mechanism called confinement. Here, they are screened by a different physical mechanism, which is called the X mechanism. So they both are screened because there is coupling between the gauge field, also because there is coupling between the gauge field and some matter fields of the theory. And at the end, only the electromagnetic forces remains visible at long distances. But there is a difference between the strong interaction and the electroweak interaction on the actual physical mechanism, which... But I will describe that later this week. Yeah. Yes?
This thing only describes massless spectral problems.
This describes?
Massless spectral problems.
Yes.
So it cannot be used for us.
Well, this point, should we continue the discussion?
Because I think it's coffee time, but the next lecture is supposed to start in a minute, I think.
Yeah, so, okay, so then I just mention, this gauge boson seems massless because of these terms. In fact, they turn out be made massive by a mechanism called the X mechanism. So massless vectors plus matter in some special way of couplings can give massive vectors plus other kind, well, another representation of matter. So if you have only gauge bosons, either they remain massless or they are not visible at all because of a mechanism called confinement. If they are coupled to matter in a very specific way, then you can make massive bosons, which is what you know seen in the weak interaction. So but that's a more complicated
story. So when you write just what's called Brock equation,
yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
The response from the X
mechanism. I don't know very well. It's different. The Brock equation.
The photon thing is actually getting very hot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because it starts to be very difficult questions. So I prefer we can discuss that. I'm not very familiar with the Brock. You are? No. Well, I remember I was able last year. I would have been last year able to answer the question. This year I have to work again. But I will discuss, I hope, in the end of this week, the X mechanism, because it's a very important mechanism. You have to understand what it shows. Okay. So thank you for your attention, and let's go to the next lecture.